Okay. All right. Well, everybody, welcome so much. I have Jody Reed here, Master Sergeant. You probably know him from his YouTube channel, Jody with a Y, nearing, 38,000 subscribers, 10 million views. He's just absolutely crushing it on YouTube. So, Jody, I appreciate you being here. Maybe you can just start off with who you are, what you're doing, why you decided to enlist in the Air Force.
So, Jody with a Y. I joined the Air Force back in 2006. I kind of made a story, one of my videos on YouTube, how I was in just a tough spot. I had a father who was in the Army for 22 years, who since I was a child had always tried to encourage me to join the military. It was just something I never wanted to do. I always saw myself doing something different. But, you know, as life kind of just smacked me in the face, and some of the choices I made in life, I kind of was trying to make a choice and I didn't know which way to go. So I talked to my dad. He highly recommended the Air Force, found the recruiter who, you know, went above and beyond to get me into the Air Force. And 17 years later, it's been one of the best choices of my life.
That's awesome, man. So why did you decide to join the Air Force specifically?
As far as the branches go, my dad told, this sounds bad, but my dad told me, don't join any of the other branches, join the Air Force, start there. And if you can't join the Air Force, then start looking at the other ones. And this is me being somebody who had no, experience or any knowledge on the military, even though my dad did 22 years, it was never something I asked him about. When he said, you know, you start with the Air Force, I just took his word for it. And that's how I did it. But as far as, you know, my choice, of why I went to the military, I guess it's just, I needed something. I needed more discipline. I was a wild child. And I was making a lot of bad choices. And I knew that if I stayed in the environment where I was, I wasn't going to clean up the choices that I made. So I just needed something to get away and put some discipline into my life. So that was my biggest reason.
Wow. So whenever you enlisted in the Air Force, what AFSC did you go into?
So my original AFSC, I was a 2A6X6, so it's an electrical and environmental system specialist. I was basically an electrician on aircraft. I got stationed out in Herbert Field, Florida, and I was working on the AC-130U when we had the AC-130U as an electrician.
Oh, that's awesome. So where have you been stationed at?
So after 17 years, I haven't been stationed in that many places. You talk to some people who've been in for 10 years and they've probably been more places than I have. But I started out in Herbert Field, Florida. For 6 years, I worked as an electrician out there. I then cross-trained into imagery analysis. I became an imagery analyst out in Langley, Virginia. And then I stayed there for about 3.5 years, almost 4 years. And then I cross-trained again into recruiting. And my recruiting tour was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I did that for about 3 years. And then I became a recruiting instructor. It got me to where I'm at right now in Lackland, San Antonio.
So what made you want to go into recruiting?
When I went into the recruiter's office originally, like when I joined, I asked the recruiter, like, how do I do your job? And he's like, oh, man, you got a long way to go before you can do my job. So I was like, I really want to do your job. It's just something that I always saw myself doing. I'm a people person. So I just felt like recruiting would be the perfect job for me to try to help people, give them something like I got from the Air Force. But it wasn't until I got into recruiting that I realized how hard my recruiter had worked for me. Just because of, you know, the type of kid that I was, in the background that I had, I didn't realize at the time how far or how above and beyond my recruiter was going for me. And then I became a recruiter and I started meeting kids with the same similar type of background as me. And I'm like, this is going to be really hard to get you in. And I was like, well, why did my recruiter do it? You know, you start thinking that, like, I didn't have any I don't feel like we had a personal relationship. I don't feel like, you know, I did anything for him to make him go out of his way. I was recruited out of Austin, Texas. Austin, Texas is not a bad place for recruiters, you know, so it wasn't like there was a lack of demand. So it just blows my mind that my recruiter went out of his way to help me get in the Air Force. But I just took that. And when I was in Cedar Rapids, I tried to give back as much as possible to as many people as I could when I was out there as a recruiter.
Wow. So I mirrored a recruiter one time because I was thinking about going into recruiting on the reserve side when I went reserve. And I was really surprised on how much paperwork is required to bring someone in. And then on top of that, if someone is not clean, right, and they don't need waivers or anything else, it's like probably exponentially more. So what are some of the more common disqualifiers for people coming in?
So the biggest disqualifiers right off bat, one is going to be weight. The thing about weight, though, is you can lose weight. So that one doesn't really permanently disqualify somebody. But that is probably one of the biggest disqualifiers that we see. And then as far as things that are a little bit harder to get cleared or get approved would be like history of medical conditions. So some of the biggest medical conditions we see, ADHD, anxiety, depression, asthma, those things, those are, man, that's when you start talking about a lot of paperwork, that's where it's coming from, those things. And then after the medical stuff, you have people with criminal background. We call them moral offenses. And then those are pretty tough to get cleared as well, depending on the level, the severity of the actual offense committed. But that's what you see most commonly, medical, some morals, I guess a lot of morals, but more so medical, and then weight is what we see most commonly.
Yeah, I read an article, and I think it was even a TEDx talk, like probably 8-9 years ago. It was a general that was talking about the amount of the American population that's ineligible to enlist. And even this article is more recently just written, but probably 3 or 4 months ago, it said like 71% of Americans are ineligible to actually enlist in the military, and they're calling it, you know, a security issue. Right. So it's interesting to hear. So do you see that stat, kind of lining up with people who are trying to enlist in the Air Force?
Man, right now, just across the DOD, not just Air Force, but the entire DOD is just struggling to recruit. There's a lot of different reasons. It's going to be hard to just pinpoint, you know, the exact reason, but the propensity of people who are eligible to serve, that is definitely adding to the equation. We're just in a time where people are disqualified. You know, it's so, like when we were growing up, if you had a medical condition, you know, it's just like, get over it. You're going to be all right. At least that's how my household was. You're going to be okay. But now, you know, you have so much access to you know, healthcare. So people are just getting
awareness
diagnosed
is more
with all kinds
as well, right?
Right. People can go online and read a symptom that they have and like, you know what? I think I got that. Go to the doctor and get diagnosed with something like that. So just people are more knowledgeable of the actual sicknesses and they're able to go get their sicknesses treated. Not to say that they weren't there in the past, just people didn't have access to go get diagnosed and stuff. But at least that's how I was seeing it from the way I was brought up, the people I was brought up around. That's one of the biggest differences I noticed.
If someone has a concern, say medically or criminally, if they have something on the record, is this something that they should call a recruiter to talk about? I know recruiters aren't experts in all medical, like that's all done at MEPS to get processed and through. So what should they do to kind of help pre-screen before they even come in?
So you can always reach out to the recruiter. One thing to remember is the recruiter is not the doctor. But these recruiters, they've seen a lot of different scenarios. So they've seen, you know, the most common disqualifications for medical stuff. So they kind of know how to help these applicants get qualified, get themselves qualified, all the necessary things they need to do. But at the end of the day, it's going to fall on the chief medical officer at MEPS, and it's also going to fall on maybe the surgeon general of whatever branch they're trying to join to get that to get approved, get qualified. But I would definitely recommend to reach out to a recruiter if you know, you know, you have some medical background that could potentially disqualify you. Just reach out to them, see what they think, and try to get a game plan on how to make it work.
Yeah. So one of the many questions that I get, I'm sure you probably get it on your channel as well, is this is my scenario. Do you think I'm eligible for it? Right. And I think there's a disconnect. Excuse me. I think there's a disconnect thinking that recruiters are the medical people, like they're the ones that are making the decision on the go or no go. But there's a whole systems and process in place for this at MEPS and even recruiting squadron wise. Right. On leadership, making that decision stuff. So I think that was probably the whole point, is to try and, it's like, there's a whole process in this. A lot of people, I think recruiters sometimes get a bad rap in that, thinking they're the ones that have to deliver the news more than likely, but don't shoot the messenger, so to speak.
And something else to remember, the recruiter, as far as like a morals waiver, like if you had a criminal background, the recruiter can do a lot to help. But as far as medical, like our opinion, our word doesn't go far in the medical process. So all we can do is get your medical records and send them up and hope. We cross our fingers we just hope that it comes back clean. But that medical process is beyond us. There's nothing the recruiter can do with their professional opinion or advice that can help an applicant get qualified. It's beyond them.
Hey, let's take a quick break. If you are all about the Air Force, then be sure to check out the newly launched Forever Wing Men YouTube channel, where we have all of these podcasts, but with our beautiful faces. Also, if you are researching the Air Force career field, then be sure to check out foreverwingman.com. There you'll find the most comprehensive data on all of the AFSCs on the entire interwebs. Not flexing at all. Lastly, if you are in the Air Force or have recently separated and want to share your story to help the next generation airmen, then reach out to me at foreverwingman.com/interview. That's foreverwingman.com/interview. Okay, back to the show. Okay, so someone has decided, they've ran through some initial pre-screening, and they think that they're eligible to enlist in the Air Force. What could someone do to prepare before they even walk in the door to talk to a recruiter?
So, like, a dream applicant for a recruiter would be someone who did their research, right? Like, they know what to expect from the process. They know the questions that they want to get answered when they go into the recruiter's office. And they also have like a sense of urgency. So a way to show that sense of urgency would be to go into a recruiter's office with all the required documents that you're going to need. So driver's license, high school diploma, social security card, birth certificate. Those are four things that you can bring in to a recruiter's office along with your questions that will show a recruiter like, oh, this person is ready to go. They're taking it serious. But also just understand the process, understand where the recruiter is in the recruiting process, understand the job process, and then also make sure that you're getting yourself physically prepared so that when it's time to go to basic training, you're not hurting yourself. Because that is one of the big, that's another issue that recruiting is having, is that people are going to basic training. They got the recruiting process taken care of, but when they get to basic training, they didn't prepare for that. So now we got them in, but we lose them in basic training. So it just puts more work on the recruiters, because now you have to fill this person who couldn't make it through basic training because of injuries, or they weren't physically fit enough to make it through.
Interesting. So can you explain a little bit more on that process if someone doesn't make it through basic training? I thought that it was like if they didn't make it through DEP, then it's up to the recruiter to fill that spot through their list of eligibles. So if someone actually goes to basic training as well.
Yeah. So you could fall out during the DEP process, but you don't normally fall out through the DEP process because of your physical limitations, unless you're like overweight. If you're not making the height and weight requirements, then yeah, you can fall out of the DEP program. But you have people who are within their height and weight requirements. But as far as the physical, PT requirements, when they go to basic training, they can't meet those. And so when they go to basic training, they're working out 3-4 times a week and their body isn't used to it. So now they start getting injuries and they just can't make it through. And now because they couldn't make it through with the physical standards, they'll send them home. And now you have the attrition at basic training that the recruiters need to fix because they're sending people who weren't physically prepared.
Okay. So on the waiver process, I know a lot of people who are enlisting in the Air Force, if they're getting advice from people who were in the Air Force or are currently in the Air Force, they'll say everything is waiverable. What does the waiver process actually look like?
So kind of there's just some things that aren't going to be waiverable, but a lot of things are, but it really depends on the recruiter and the relationship they have with the applicant. Okay. So like someone like me, because, you know, of my background and me realizing how far my recruiter went out of his way to get me into the Air Force, I took it. I was passionate about helping people in my situation. Most people, you know, they have their own. The thing about being a recruiter, you are the hiring professional, right? So although, you know, the applicant may disclose that they're really interested in joining, the recruiter at the end of the day is the one who's hiring. So if there's something that they don't agree with or something they don't jive with the applicant, you know, based off of their own, you know, personal decisions or personal opinions, it could halt somebody's process. And the regulations are totally in line with that. It says that, you know, there's like a blurb in the regulations to say it's at the recruiter's discretion to work a waiver or not. So when you have something gray like that, it allows a lot of room for gray with these recruiters and how they make their decisions on which waivers they're going to approve or which ones they aren't. So yes, not everything can be waiverable, but a lot can be waiverable, but it doesn't mean that you're going to get the waiver.
Yeah, without a doubt. And so I highly recommend a book. I don't know if you've read it or not. It's called When Friends Influence People by Dale Carnegie. When Friends
what was the
Influence
book again?
People.
I think I've read, I'm not sure. If it sounds familiar.
Okay. So highly, highly recommend it. It's just about how we interact with people, right? And how you present yourself and project yourself. And I think that that's a key point in what you said is that the recruiters are the hiring. Like this is an interview. The way that you present yourself, you know, showing up in sweats and flip flops, hair undone and unshaven and everything like that, that sends a message regardless whether you like that or not. It sends a message. So,
right.
So I think that if you project yourself in a professional manner, then I think you'll put yourself in a better position. What do you think?
You know what's crazy? In my time as a recruiter, so many applicants showed up rolling out of bed. You know, like that's the kind of energy they gave to the recruiting office. Like you wouldn't do that anywhere else. Like if you were going for a job, you would not roll out of bed and go present yourself to the hiring official. But they do it to recruiters. And so when the recruiters see you come in the office, you know, unintentionally or not, subconsciously or not, they're sizing you up. And when you come in and you have that story, you know, I had this happen. They're deciding, you know, with their limited amount of time that they have because their schedule's so busy, do I give it to you? Do I give any of my time to you? And if you look like you rolled out of bed, you know, that weighs in the equation if they're going to do that waiver. So something to consider.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so someone walked in, they're eligible. What are the next steps? Do they go to MEPS at that point or they do any kind of pre-ASVAB tests?
So they definitely going to want to do some type of pre-ASVAB. The recruiters, they can do a PICAT, which they allow them to take an ASVAB at home. Those scores can stick, but they have to go to MEPS and they have to take a verification test to ensure no one cheated or anything was going on when they took that test at home. So they got to keep that in mind. If you take a PICAT, you know, you will have to take a verification test at MEPS. They also have, what do they call it? APT. I think that's another practice test. That's just the practice test. It doesn't stick. It just kind of gives a recruiter an idea of how you will score on the ASVAB. The recruiters want to have these practice tests so they know, should I send you to MEPS? Because they don't want to send you to MEPS if you're going to go down there and have a failing score. So they just kind of want to get a gauge with the practice test before they send you. And then once they get the practice test, they're also going to have to do a lot of paperwork. There's going to be a lot of forms that need to be signed in order for you to get a date at MEPS. So once the ASVAB is done, once the practice ASVAB is done, once all the forms are done to get you to MEPS and the medical process is cleared, because you got to get cleared to go to MEPS as well, then they'll send you to MEPS, take the real ASVAB, take a physical. It's just like a sports physical. They're going to look your body over, make sure everything's ready to go. And then once you complete the MEPS process, the recruiter is expecting you to swear in to the delayed entry program. And that's for active duty. If this is with reserve or if this was with the Air National Guard, they're expecting you to come back and swear into their component. So a lot of people think they're going to go to MEPS and just figure things out, see how the cards land. But I always tell them, hey, when you go to MEPS, this is game on. Like they're trying to make this official. So you're going to swear into the delayed entry program if you're active duty, and then you're going to come back and just wait. For active duty, you're going to wait for a job opportunity to present itself while you're waiting in a DEP. And with with Air National Guard and with Air Force Reserve, you're going to get a job with your recruiter when you come back and then actually swear into the Air Force Reserve or swear into the Air National Guard.
What does the timeline look like for...
Hope I didn't make that confusing.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, the delay. So we can plant a flag in the delayed enlistment program for just 1 second, and you could probably go into a little bit more detail on what that might actually look like. What does it look like before you actually go to MEPS? What's the timeline typically look like? I know it's probably going to be dependent on
right now,
studying for ASVAB and everything else.
So if your ASVAB is ready to go, if you go in, you have a good practice ASVAB, it's really going to come down to two things. How much availability the MEPS has and how busy your recruiter is. And it's also going to come down to your medical background. There's a system out there now called Genesis. And Genesis is basically pulling people's medical record. So the MEPS is able to see, you know, people's medical record. So back in the day, I'll be honest with you, people would come into the military and they wouldn't disclose certain medical information to their recruiters. And there's really no way for the recruiter to know. But now that's not happening anymore. People aren't able to hide medical background or medical conditions as they once were before. So the system called Genesis is finding everything and it's delaying people's process. So if there's anything medically in your background, that could delay your process maybe 1, 2, 3 months. Maybe 4 months, just depending on, you know, what the medical conditions are. And that is what is causing that that delay from meeting a recruiter to getting to MEPS. So it's tough, man. I would say, you know, back in the day, you know, it's probably like a month, maybe 2 weeks from meeting a recruiter to MEPS. But now you're probably looking at 2 to 4 month timelines.
So what is MEPS actually look like, the environment? Because I was always, so I processed through MEPS in active duty, and then I had to go through it when I went through the reserve. And it's always a little bit of a shock on the environment and what it actually looks like. Can you explain just kind of what people could expect when they first walk in the door in MEPS?
So it depends on the MEPS. The one in Cedar Rapids, there was this lady at when you walked in. She was a mean little lady. She wanted to set the tone, right off bat. Like so, she's almost yelling. So I want people to know that like you could walk into a MEPS and there may be somebody with a loud tone or hard tone yelling at you, just to kind of set the tone for you, so you know how the day is gonna go. They don't want anybody, you know, not paying attention or having to tell the directions too many times. So that may happen. But then afterwards, it's just kind of like hurry up and wait. You're going to have depending on, you know, the I guess the day, it could be a lot of people there and they're trying to get everybody through, and they're doing it one by one, you know, because of personal information. They can't have everybody going through certain parts at the same time. So, you know, they'll tell you, hey, go get your eyes checked and go sit and wait. And we'll call you when it's time for your ears. You get your ears checked, go sit and wait. We'll call you when it's time for your blood to be drawn. You know, so there's a lot of hurry up and wait. And they don't allow you to have your phone. I heard some MEPs are allowing phones now. I'm not sure. But you're not supposed to have your phone. So you're just kind of sitting in this lobby, just waiting to finish the process. So it's not a fun day. I would say that. But it is a necessary day that people have to go through.
No, can they do the ASVAB test and the medical and everything in one day? Or is that typically split up into 2 days?
So they can. It's called a same day, where they schedule you to take the ASVAB and the physical all in the same day. A lot of recruiters don't like that. And the MEPS liaisons don't really like it either. It's a lot of work to get somebody ASVAB and physical in the same day. So they would prefer to do it what they call a one stop, where you're ASVAB the day before and then you're physical the next day. It's a lot less workload on the MEPS personnel. Yes, you can do it, but it's not the most common way of scheduling someone.
Okay, gotcha. Hey, Jody, I'm going to just take a quick break right here. How's your video going right now?
What do you mean?
So I got you frozen. Do you have me? Okay.
I got you. Yeah, everything looks good on my end.
Okay, got it. I forgot to tell you at the beginning of the recording, that if for whatever reason we do lose video, if we can still hear each other, then everything is good to go. But on this side, it looks like I lost video on your side. So no worries. We'll just keep on going with it.
I'm going to change, my Wi-Fi to the,
line check.
The one right that, yeah. I'm changing my Wi-Fi to my extender. I wasn't on my extension of Wi-Fi, so hopefully that.
I think yours is pretty good, only because I see the amount of video that's already uploaded is 99%. So it's actually uploading as you're going. Okay, there's the video. It's back now.
Okay.
And so more than likely, it's on my side. Out here in Marshall Islands, we have like 5 megabits per second, so it's it's basically dial up. So it's I can almost assume it's my side, but I just wanted to make sure that everything was good on your side too.
Okay.
Okay, cool. Okay. So running through MEPS, after you get done with MEPS, what happens after that? Do they start building their jobs list, or they actually do that before they even go to MEPS?
So most recruiters are going to make sure you kind of have an idea of what jobs you want to do before you get there. The last thing they want to do is send you down to the job liaison or the MEPS liaison. Those terms are interchangeable. It's the same person. Last thing they want to do is send you down there and you have no idea what you want to do because it's going to slow down the MEPS process. So they kind of want you to come prepared, do some research. I always told people to use your website to do their research. But get their research done. And then at the end, after everything is done, your ASVAB, after your physical, you're going to start listing jobs with the job liaison. If you're doing a guard process or if you're doing a reserve process, your process stops at the end of the physical and you're going to come back to your recruiter and do the job process with them after you're done.
Okay. So they build their list. Any pro tips on actually building the list itself?
I say talk to the recruiter and see where the demand is.
Okay.
We get so many people who say, you know, I'm going to join the Air Force. I love it, everything about it. And I'm going to be in the medical field. I'm going to be a firefighter, or I'm going to be a loadmaster, area refueler. You know, the jobs that everybody wants to do, right? The high demand jobs, low supply. And then when you tell them like, hey, we don't have those jobs, now they're upset. You know, Now they're like, well, I don't want to join anymore. So I would say if you're joining for a job, then I don't think the Air Force or the military is the place to join for a specific job. It's more than a job. It's a career. Most of the people are joining for a reason. Like me, I need a discipline in my life.
Yeah.
You have people who need education, or you have people who just need to get away from their current situation. The job is the cherry on top. You know, I always say join for whatever that big reason of why you even thought the military originally. Nobody thinks the military for a job.
Yeah.
It's something usually bigger than that. So don't let the job hold you up, and talk with your recruiter about what jobs are in demand. And if you start booking, if you start creating a list off of those jobs, then you're not going to have a problem getting a job in while you're waiting. But if you're trying to list all the jobs that we don't have, you're going to be waiting, and you're probably going to be upset with your recruiter as well.
So what are the typical number of jobs that their recruiting station requires recruits to put on their list?
So it varies from squadron to squadron. My squadron made people list 7 to 10 jobs.
Okay.
That was what they told us. Hey, make sure your people are listing 7 to 10 jobs in one aptitude area. So the aptitude area is basically like an open contract. And we have 4 different ones. You have the administration, general, mechanical, and electrical. Basically means if you list one of those aptitude areas, you're going to get a job within that field. I went to basic training with an electrical aptitude area. I ended up getting electrical and environmental specialist when I got to basic training. So my squadron would say list 7 to 10 in one aptitude area. You have some squadrons to say you're going to list 15 jobs. I even heard some say you're going to list as many as 20.
Wow.
So it just depends on which squadron, what location you're getting recruited from.
Okay. On the job selection, I think there's a little bit of a mystery on how that process actually works. Like, is there a benefit to go in open aptitude? Is there a benefit to having larger populated jobs, which obviously equates to more job openings and probably more likely to actually get something like that? How does the job selection typically work? I know it probably varies from squadron to squadron, but on average.
So it's changed a bit since I was a recruiter. Back in the day, it used to be more people oriented. Basically, there were people who were looking at lists that applicants created and trying to match people to jobs. From what I understand, and I could be wrong, but from what I understand, most squadrons are going to more towards a system. It's basically there's a system. It's looking at what people listed, what's available, and it's just matching people.
It's
taking the people out of it. So it's not, you know, there's no, I guess there's no preference. Some people are like, why didn't I get my number one job? It was a system. It wasn't a person who did that. It was a system. That's my understanding of the job process now. So if you list a job, it's basically going to get put into a system and match you to what's available based off of your job list. I could be wrong, like I said, but from what I'm hearing from recruiters out there, that seems to be the most common way of how the job process is.
Is there an influence on when someone says they want to ship, say someone who might be in high school, they have to get through graduation, obviously, then they hit the summer time frame, or someone who might be a little bit older, finished a semester in college or something like that? Is that a factor into the decision process?
So they're looking at date of availability. So the system is going to look at ASVAB. It's going to look at what you listed, date of availability, all of that. And if you say that you're ready to go now, then, you know, it's going to look at the jobs that are the soonest leaving jobs.
Yeah.
So it's going to try to match you to something like that. But if you have your date of availability 6 months out, this you won't even be able to book a job, because normally squadrons don't have jobs 6 months out. They usually within 3 to 4 month time frames.
Okay.
So if you have a date of availability 6 months out, you're probably not going to book a job until you get closer to that 3 to 4 month range.
What's the advantage, or what's the process look like for someone who goes open aptitude and them actually getting their job selection?
So if you go open and then whatever field that you went, or whatever aptitude area you got selected for, you're going to go to basic training and they're going to present to you a list of jobs within that aptitude area. So if you went a mechanical aptitude, You're going to get to basic training. You're going to see whatever mechanical jobs they have available at that time. The thing about it is they don't always have every mechanical job available. So you never, and it's week to week. That job pool changes week to week in basic training. So you may hear somebody who went the week before you, they say that they saw jet engine mechanic, they saw a bunch of crew chief jobs. And then when you go, you see like hydraulic or yeah. you see, you know, something else. So you never know what's going to be available, but they'll present to you a list and then you basically rank what you would like to do. Just like you would if you went when you did your original job process with your recruiter, you're going to list these jobs, rank them from one to whatever. And then a system is going to give you your job in basic training. And I think fifth week is when you find out what job you got. And then you go to tech school for their job when you graduate basic training.
OK, so I had heard from a couple other recruiters. I haven't been able to validate this or not. And you may not be able to validate, but they'd said that that there's an advantage of going open. That when job availabilities come, that first it's people who are being reclassed or failed tech school and they need to find another job. They get the first selection of that list. Then it goes down to people who are in basic training who've gone open, and then the recruiting stations get allocated from that point on. Kind of a tier system. Is that kind of how you've seen it?
So it used to be that way.
Okay.
And I could be wrong. Like I've been out of the actual recruiting game since 2019. I try to stay up with the new changes. But from what I've heard, when I was recruiting, yes, aptitude okay. areas were great because most of the jobs were at basic training. So
yeah, the smaller recruiters career fields were more getting, yeah, ones that people highly desired, right? Training. Public affairs. Yeah.
Right. But now there's been a shift to where they're trying to give, I guess, specific jobs to the recruiters now. Before, it was like, we're going to give you a bunch of aptitude areas and we'll figure it out in basic training. But now they're like, you all figure it out at your level. And so now the aptitude areas are more of jobs that are reclass. So,
okay.
So if somebody like failed out of their tech school, now that job needs to be, they still need to fill that job. And from what I'm hearing, those are the jobs that you're seeing in the aptitude areas now. Not to say that it's a bad thing, but it's not the same way as it was when I was recruiting, at least from how I'm understanding. I could be wrong. I don't want to get in trouble for saying that. But I believe that's how it's working right now.
Okay.
But like I said, I could be wrong.
So for anyone that's listening, ask the recruiter that question itself and see if there's an advantage, because it might kind of work into your strategy on getting probably the more desired jobs if that's still into play. If not, then don't even factor that part in. So it's
right.
I think
the recruiters are going to be, the recruiters are more connected to the job processes and stuff like that more than I am. You know, I am a recruiting instructor, so I'm teaching them more how to recruit. The yeah. actual processes, the job processes and things like that. We don't really, that's something they're going to learn on the job. We teach the basics, but they're going to get down into the weeds when they actually get out there. So they're going to be a little bit more experienced with all the changes and everything that's happening, more than I am.
Gotcha. Okay. So, you've created your jobs list. You've sworn into DEP if you're active duty. What exactly is DEP and what does that look like?
So you're saying what is the DEP process? Like, what are you
yeah,
doing?
Yeah, so the delayed enlistment program. So what is that? And then what does that look like? I assume that there's commander's calls and stuff like that. And what's that look like?
So when you get into the DEP, this can be anywhere from like 1 to 12 months, you know, just yeah. depending on your job list, depending on your availability. You could be sitting in the DEP really quickly, or you could be hanging out for a while. During that process, you want to get as familiar as possible with basic training. Just prepare yourself as much as possible. Try to make it easier on yourself when you get there. Basic training can be tough, so the more you prepare, the easier it can be. So you're definitely preparing for basic. You're also maintaining your standard, but that's probably going to be the most important thing, is to maintain who you were when you got sworn into the delay entry program. Don't change. So if you got sworn into the delayed entry program with one speeding ticket, then when you ship to basic training, have one speeding ticket.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, don't start racking them up while you're in the delayed entry program. Same thing with like weight, medical conditions. Just be who you were when you went to MEPS. And also get physically prepared as well. That's where we're starting to lose applicants, is they're not physically prepared. I know I mentioned it earlier, but definitely got to physically prepare yourself to get ready for basic training. So when you get to basic training, we don't start running into injuries that we could have prevented just by preparing while in a delayed entry program.
So and, how often?
The Air National Guard, they call it the student flight. It's the equivalent to the delayed entry program. And the reserve, they call theirs the development and training flight. It's similar to the delayed entry program. So both, all three, you're doing those things.
So is there, I think when I went through way back in 1999, we did like a commander's calls and stuff where we'd come in, they'd go over, teach us whether it be marching. We'd do obviously all the standards weigh in and stuff. Or memorization, that kind of stuff, rank recognition, kind of review that stuff. Are they still kind of doing that in depth?
It depends on the recruiter. If the recruiter wants to go over memory work with their applicants, they can. A lot of recruiters got away from the marching and doing all the drill movements because they were sending people to basic training, and the kids are going there acting like they know something, but they were taught wrong. So yeah, it's a lot of, you know, breaking them down, reteaching them that the TIs were having to do. So your recruiters kind of got away from that. But, you know, me, myself, when I did depth calls, we would work out. We would have some type of workout. We would also do like team building things. I would throw barbecues. We would go to places and kind of have a good time. Yeah. It's also a time for me to get eyes on my depth members, making sure that nothing changed and making sure they still had the motivation to join. The depth man, some people, they're super excited when they go to MEPS. You know, they're making a big choice. All the feelings and emotions are high. And then now they're waiting 6 months. Anything can happen. You know, they get a new girlfriend, new boyfriend, get a new job. Anything can change. And so the depth time was my time to kind of look at my depth members and kind of see what the energy was like and if there was anything I needed to do to get them remotivated as well.
Okay. Are there any ways that people can get a little bit more involved with the recruiting squadron, just to plug in a little bit more into that Air Force life that they're joining?
You say get plugged into the recruiting squadron?
Yeah, like it's volunteer like, or just learn a little bit more about the Air Force or talk to new recruits or anything like that. Is that kind of a thing or is it just pretty much come in, meet the standards, and then participate in whatever function that might be happening, and then kind of we'll see you next month?
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, kind of on what the recruiter has for their delayed entry program. I don't think I had too many opportunities for them to get involved any more than my delayed entry programs. Okay. I did have a depth commander. So basically, if I had a junior, right, if I was putting in a junior, basically they were going into their senior year, I knew they were going to be in my depth for a long time, right? So I could make them a depth commander, and basically they had responsibility of ensuring that everybody came to depth. They may even teach the new applicants or the new depth members what to expect, what to do when we get there. So I kind of gave that responsibility to somebody. But as far as anything else getting involved, I don't think I had those opportunities for people. Trying to think.
It's no worries, because I'm the type of person that like wants to get involved. Like if I have a new thing, like I want to lean forward and do it, but also I know that could probably recruiters' times are extremely limited, right? So sometimes that can be even more of a burden than be helpful, right?
Yeah. I think it would for, you know, you have a depth member who's constantly trying to be involved with the recruiter, because the Air Force recruiters are a one man band. Unlike some of the other branches, they have multiple recruiters doing one job. The Air Force is just one person doing all of the jobs. Mm. So, you know, I love the, I guess the excitement of an applicant who wants to do more, wants to learn more, but they could be could get a little bothersome to a recruiter when they still got to go to their schools. They still got to go out in the community and do all their events. They have all the appointments that they have to conduct. That could be a little bothersome if they have that applicant who's like, you know, what can I do today to, you know, get better? I'm not saying don't bother your recruiters, because I want people to engage with their recruiters. Just know that the recruiters can be busy and you may not get the communication you want instantly in a recruiter schedule.
So that's a really good segue into the next question. And I think it's a little bit difficult conversation to have. And that's what happens if someone is having a really difficult time with their recruiter, because personality clashes, it happens in the Air Force, happens in the real world. Like, humans are messy. If someone's having a difficult time with the recruiter, what options do they have? There's a lot of questions that I get on through email and through the Facebook group is can I leave my recruiter and go to someone else? I know there's probably second or third degree effects of doing that, bad and good, probably. What advice would you give to someone that might be having some issues with the recruiter?
So it depends. Like, if they're still in high school, they pretty much have to work with that recruiter, because that recruiter is responsible for their high school. And it will be considered what we call poaching if another recruiter was to work this recruiter's high schools.
Got it.
So if there's an issue with the recruiter and you're in high school, you got to figure that issue out. You can also get in touch with their flight chief. You should meet the flight chief, or you should at least get the flight chief's information when you originally start working with your recruiter.
Yeah.
The flight chief is the boss of the recruiter. So you can always address concerns up to the flight chief if you're not getting any traction with the actual recruiter. And maybe the flight chief can figure out, you know, how we're going to do it. Are we going to swap recruiters around or whatnot? But they'll have the final say in a situation like that. If you're not in high school, the Air Force has kind of started cracking down on poaching altogether. So even if you're not in high school and they find recruiters working applicants from other people's zones, because each recruiter gets a specific zone that they're working and they're supposed to stay within that zone. Once you start going outside of that zone, now you're poaching and starting to work other people's applicants. So the Air Force has, you know, kind of said like no poaching. But in a situation like that where you're not getting attraction and you're not in high school, that's one of those, you know, gray areas. You can kind of search around, maybe find another recruiter. Just make sure you voice your reason of why you're even reaching out to them when they're not responsible for your zone of recruiting. And then if there's any reason why they can't work you, they'll let you know and possibly figure out, you know, what you need to do with your current recruiter to make the relationship better or fix it or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. So a few things on that. You're going to run into situations like that in your Air Force career, right? It's better to start early on how to actually work through the problem. Right. And I think we can, when someone in some book that I read is said, it's like 70% of all problems can be solved with just better communication, right? If we just communicate and dialogue and have the tough conversations, professionally, right, then I think we could solve a lot of problems. And that's probably what most of the issue is, at least in some of the scenarios that I've heard that people have explained to me, is it sounds like it's just communication. They said something that you don't necessarily agree with, or you're not sure what the regs say or whatever the case may be. I think you have a huge resource, and through like someone like your YouTube channel, you know, just doing the research. I'm very, very hesitant to recommend Reddit, only because you can get a varying amount of answers, professional and unprofessional. But you have the internet at your disposal too. Take that with a grain of sand. You have access to almost all the Air Force regulations if you need to do some research and just have a discussion about it. Not a you're wrong type thing that the reg says this. Like that's the worst way to bring up something with someone is to throw the reg in their face. You're going to get nothing but stoppage in communication in that. So I think that people need to be able to work through it. And I would not advise, just from a reputational standpoint, people going out there and jumping from a recruiter to another one? Because like you said, this is an interview, right? Would you do that in a normal job interview? Would you jump around to a different interviewer saying that, you know, you don't agree with the question that they ask you? Like, no, this is still an interview. Even after you go into MEPS and you're in depth and you're waiting for your shipment, right? Is you're waiting, you're still being interviewed. So I usually tell people that it just comes down to communication. Just have the tough conversations. And I don't think there's anything wrong with just calling a recruiter and asking the same question and just say, hey, I'm not sure if that's right. They said this, does that sound right to you? And they say, oh yeah, that's right. And it's like, okay, then that's it. Right. But I think they have a plethora of resources available to actually, number one, find out the information. I think the medical is probably the biggest thing that people have questions on. Because it is a little bit gray and MEPS are, they're, I guess, what they're run by MEPCON, which is an Army organization. So it's a little bit different.
It's not even us.
Yeah. that is a little bit more of a gray mystery area. And we're kind of at the mercy of the decision of the, you said, the chief medical officer. Unfortunately, it is what it is on that part. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
So I would just say, keep an open mind. You know, some people, they want, you know, they woke up one morning, they said, I'm going to do it. You know, they got motivated and they want stuff to happen like right now. Like, put me in, do my appointment, get me to MEPS, get me a job like right now. And not understanding, you know, the process or the time frames of what they should expect. Now, then you actually get real cases where, you know, they're not getting any traction from their recruiter for whatever the case may be. I don't even know what to say about that. But, you know, I see it in my comments a lot. You know, I reach out to the recruiter 5-6 times, haven't gotten any traction. In those cases, you might want to up it, you know, up the chain of command, try to get in touch with the flight chief or something. But in the cases where you're just not, they're not moving as fast as you want to move, just be a little bit more patient, be a little bit more open-minded and knowing like this is a one-man show. They have a lot of people trying to join and they gotta dedicate their time evenly to everyone. And as much as they want to get you in the Air Force, there's somebody else that they have to get in as well. So just be a little bit more patient with that.
Yeah. So I had a mentor of mine, Colonel Matthews. He's actually, I interviewed just a little bit, a couple episodes ago. He was my commander at AFRICOM and I worked as a civilian. And I can get extremely impatient when I'm trying to get things worked through, right? But we have to remember that the DOD as a whole and the Air Force is part of the federal government, right? Which is a giant machine. There's bureaucracy in place. There's systems and processes and check marks we have to get in order to get things done. That's just the way it is. And I think that, and he said, Josh, you just need to show a little bit more tactical patience. It's like,
yes.
It's like, just let it play out. Let it play out. The process is there for a reason. It'll eventually get there. Just breathe through it and work on something else. Right. And I think that's probably some advice that we could give to people that are going, is to show a little bit of tactical patience. Things will play out. You'll get through if you're eligible and you qualified. You will get there. Right. You just got to see it through.
Right. I teach my students, they're recruiters. I teach them flexibility is probably one of the biggest keys to being a recruiter because things change. Like you may have a whole day scheduled. This is your plan. And then something comes up, throws the entire schedule off. And if you're not a flexible person, you're going to be mad. And then you start carrying that energy into your appointments. And it's just a snowball effect. And things just start going down from there. So even for the applicants, I would say the flexibility is going to be key in your process. Because if you're not, you could be pissed off at your recruiter. And the next thing you know, things just go bad. So
bad.
Just maintain some flexibility, some tactical patience, and you'll see the process through.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so they're in depth. They get a text message or a phone call from the recruiter saying, we've got a job for you. What does the notification process look like? And then what is the actual timeline from you get notified to you're heading off to MEPS for shipment? And what does that look like?
It could be through text message. I would say that text message is probably one of the biggest ways of communication nowadays, especially when I recruited. The kids would respond to a text. I could call them. They wouldn't pick up. I text them 10 seconds later. I get a response. So most likely you're going to get a job notification through text saying, hey, we got you a job. And then you would have to come in and sign your contracts, either do a 4 or 6 year contract. As far as leaving to basic training, that job, it could be next month. It could be 4 to 5 months from now, just depending on the seat that they have available. Now, they do have opportunities for someone to what we call quick ship. And I think right now it comes with a $8,000 bonus.
Okay.
I could be wrong. It could be $6,000. Basically, they pay you more money for taking a quick ship opportunity. And something like that, you kind of lose the control over what job you get, because a quick ship job is normally a job that someone lost. Somebody may have gotten in trouble. Somebody may have gotten hurt. Somebody may have lost disinterest and no longer wants to join anymore. So now that job becomes available and they need to fill it. And they need somebody to take it fast. So that will be where a quick ship opportunity comes. So a recruiter would normally call you and say, hey, this job just came available. It's leaving next week. Do you want it? It also comes with the $8,000 bonus. So that will be on the applicant to make a quick decision. You know, okay. do I take it? Do I go now? Or do I just wait for the normal job process and ship during those times?
Okay. And the day of shipping, what does that look like?
So basically, you know, you want to have your bag. You're going to sit down with the recruiter one more time, make sure nothing has changed since you originally depped in. And then they're either going to drive you themselves to MEPS. You're going to take a shuttle to MEPS, or you can go with your family to MEPS. And you're going to basically go back and do an inspection with the Air Force liaison. Just make sure everything is good to go. Make sure all your paperwork is good to go. And then depending on how close you are to San Antonio, you either fly or you may bus to San Antonio to go to basic training. So ship day is actually not bad. It's pretty easy. But, you know, the nerves are running. The nerves are high. It's like, this is happening. Oh my God. But as far as the process, it's not that harsh.
Okay. So one last question. And that's, what if someone is getting cold feet or life situation changes a little bit and they decide that the Air Force isn't for them? What can they pretty much just break the news to the recruiter at any point in that? Or are they locked in at any certain point?
So if you did active duty, right, and you're in a delayed entry program, you actually can. I'm not going to lie. You actually can tell the recruiter, look, I got cold feet. I don't want to do this anymore. And they can't force you to go to basic training. The Air Force Reserve and the Air National Guard, once you come back from MEPS and you take that job, you're actually sworn in. You're actually a member of the reserve. You're actually a member of the Air National Guard. So it's a little bit trickier for them. But for active duty, definitely you can. And it happened a lot. I got a lot of applicants who would get the cold feet. So it's a normal thing. That's the first thing people need to know, is it's normal for you to get cold feet. But getting people back on track, I had a high success rate with that. So if they had cold feet, I was able to get them back on track, and I was able to do it in a genuine and honest way. Every time somebody came into my office, the original first time I met them, I always asked them, you know, why are you joining beyond the job? Like we were talking about, don't join for a job. Why are you joining? And I would want to have that conversation with them to figure out, you know, what's going on with their life and how I'm going to be able to help. So once I found out how I was going to be able to impact their life and make it better, I explained that to them, like, this is how the Air Force is going to help you. This is why I think you should join, for the Air Force to be able to help correct that situation that you're going through. So now when they're getting cold feet, sometimes I have to remind them, like, yo, like, you just, you know, when you came in, you were one bill away from being homeless. Like, what's going on? You know, like,
yeah.
And make kind of like re-jog their memory, because sometimes people, they can let the doubt just start clouding up their mind. And now the doubt outweighs the original reason why they were joining anyway. So it's just clearing that doubt, getting that fog out of their head, trying to make them remember why they were joining.
No, that's
so
great.
It happens. It definitely happens. And like I say, for those people who were feeling like that, just try to go back to why you were originally joining.
Yeah, 110%, man. Remember your why you decided to do it in the first place. That's really good advice. Really good advice. Okay, so that's the recruitment process. Is there anything that you think that we might have missed? Any misconceptions or anything else? I think we talked about a lot, though.
Man, recruiting is bad right now. Just overall. So, you know, I just want people to know, like, you know, there's a lot that's attributing to the bad recruiting times, but it's kind of like, it sounds messed up, but it's kind of like we need this new generation. We need this young generation to come in and fix whatever problems they have with the military.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of old people making decisions. And we need those young people to help us
blood.
See, you know, say it again.
And we need that fresh blood, their influence.
Yeah. We need help us make it the way you want it to be. Help us see it the way you want it to be. Cause the older people are not going to be able to do it on their own. They're going to need the fresh mind, the fresh blood to help us make the changes that we need to make. So that's just my message, I guess, to the overall public. I know whatever, you know, you have in mind of why the Air Force recruiting is messed up, whatever that is, we need you to help us fix it.
Yeah. I totally agree, man. So I usually don't even refer to like recruits as recruits, or I usually refer to them as the next generation airmen, right?
Right.
They're the ones that are taking the baton from the airmen that are in now. That they're the ones that are going to be the future master sergeants, right? Like yourself and chief master sergeants of the Air Force. They're the ones that are going to be in those positions of influence to make those changes that are needed, right? That the Air Force and the federal government as a whole is like I said, is a giant machine, which the giant machine, it's difficult to change. Which it's like culture, right? It just takes a lot of time and influence and consistency to make those long-term changes. And we absolutely need people in the next generation to come over and take the baton and to lead from the front. The Air Force of today is not going to look like the Air Force of 10 years from now or 20 years from now, which is the way it's supposed to be, right? We're supposed to be flexible in the way that we do business. We're the greatest Air Force in the world. Even though I'm a veteran, I'm outside, I'm on this side of the wire, so to speak. I still have a lot of pride of the people that are serving now, of the young people and the next generation airmen that are enlisting now, that they're the ones that are going to be molding and shaping the Air Force. So yeah, I agree with you.
Yep. And it's crazy because when I first joined, I never thought I would have an impact or the space that I have now to impact the next generation. So it's crazy. Like when you're 17, 18 years old, you're not thinking about, you know, it's my responsibility. We're going to be the ones taking the baton. You're not thinking like that.
Exactly.
But it's going to happen. And we need them.
And it is. And it's through content like yours that's helping them. And if you imagine, and I do this with Forever Wingman on the website, with the number of page views or the number of visitors that come on there, you have 10 million views. Like that's 10 million eyes of people that are listening to your voice, right? Which is just mind-boggling if you even think about it, of the amount of influence that you have And the young people that are coming in, enlisting in the Air Force, the influence that they'll have, because they'll, social media is there, man. It's there to stay. And right. they can broadcast their message, just like you're doing now. So I'll, make a segue into the last question I try to ask guests. And that is, if your cousin, your son, daughter, nephew, some stranger off the street, came to you, said that they're thinking about enlisting in the Air Force, what words of advice would you give them on how to be actually successful once they're in the Air Force?
So I know you probably heard it. When you join, try to make yourself as quiet as possible, make yourself like a ninja to where nobody can see you, stay out of everybody's eyes. That way you can have a smooth ride. And I would recommend the opposite. I would recommend, go in and do everything you can to try to make change and make yourself present and heard. Because everyone has like a voice, everyone has, something that they can share. And a lot of the times they hide it. They don't want to share it. They feel like they may be outspoken or overtalked by somebody else. But, and then the ones who are the most, bodacious, those are the ones we constantly keep hearing, with their bodacious ideas, where some of these people who are a little bit more reserved, more passive, we're missing out. So I would say, you know, just be the opposite of quiet and passive, like get your voice heard, share your ideas, cause we need them and we need to change.
Great advice. Jody, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing the entire recruitment process. I know we covered a lot of information. And thank you again for your content on, Jody with a Y, on the YouTube channel, nearing 37,000-38,000 subscribers, which is awesome. So, all the listeners that may be listening to this, go check him out. He's got a ton of great content. And be sure to, what do you say, like, comment, subscribe. I think you even said in one of your videos that people are calling you out for not saying that. So I'll say it here for you. Like, comment, subscribe, click the bell.
I appreciate you.
Yeah, absolutely. Jody, take care.